Chapter 11, NBC Radio.
Tell me how many heads of state you've talked to.
Well, we start in the beginning with American presidents. I've talked to five of them. Four of them, either before they were in office or after they were in office. The fifth, Ronald Reagan, we knew one another from Sacramento, and when he was governor, and I had access to him that very few other reporters had. There's a story I like to tell about Reagan that he knew me well from covering numerous press conferences in Sacramento and various personal interviews as well during his tenure as governor. And there was a trick in television that looked so good if you could do it. And if it was staged, it really didn't come off. And anyhow, television frowned on anything being staged. But Reagan would let me walk up to him when he got off a plane and the press corps was out on the runway. And I could walk up to him and he would brush the Secret Service aside. This was after he became a nominee for the Republican presidential race. This was while he was fighting to become a nominee. And I could walk up to him from a distance at an airport as he was coming off down the ramp and onto the runway. He would brush the Secret Service apart and let me, with camera rolling, walk in and throw a question at him, and he'd answer it and move on. It was a little thing we did. He knew I wasn't going to sandbag him, and he let me get away with it. Only one other person let me do that, and that was George McGovern when he was a candidate for the presidency. McGovern, for some reason, liked me, and he didn't get the kind of press coverage that Reagan got anyhow. Mm. So I could do that with George McGovern as well. But presidents, I went walking on Nob Hill with Harry Truman after he was president. A group of four or five reporters went strolling with him, asking questions, him answering. We had tape recorders and the funny part about that whole walk, he's charming, and he was in great spirits, was after about 10 minutes of walking and everything quieted down, he said, "What's the matter with you fellows? Don't you have any more questions to ask?" That was my Harry Truman. I did George Walker Bush before he was president, when he was the head of the Republican National Committee.
Wow.
This goes back a long ways. He had a press conference in San Francisco, and I stayed on after the press conference, and we talked for about a half hour.
Wow.
This wasn't for broadcast or anything. We just talked. I did Jack Kennedy at the Democratic Convention in 1960 in Los Angeles, when Pierre Salinger, who was a friend of mine from his Chronicle reporting days, I had some information on the Pennsylvania delegation, I think it was. And I called Pierre and told him, and he said, "Give it to me fast." And I said, "No, I'll give it to Jack." And he said, "Let me get back to you." And he arranged for me to go into Kennedy's suite, and it was only Pierre, Kennedy, and myself. I interviewed Kennedy, who was sitting in an armchair with a hassock with his feet up, in his stocking feet, drinking a Heineken, gave him the information that I had on Pennsylvania. He was much appreciated. It was good information that they didn't have. That was my experience with President Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson, I did at that same convention when, after Kennedy was nominated, and he was going to name who his vice presidential candidate, who he wanted to run with him. And nobody expected it to be Lyndon Johnson. But it was one of those outside things. And for some reason, I got assigned to Johnson, and I was on a stakeout outside of his door at the hotel. And the news came that Kennedy had chosen Lyndon. And the press descended on that room in mass. And within a short amount of time, Lyndon opened the door, and there I was standing right in front. I had the microphone out, and I got Lyndon's first response on the honor to be the vice presidential candidate with JFK.
Wow.
Let's see, who am I leaving out? Well, let's go on to other heads of state in other countries. Let's see, I'll just run through thinking of the American presidents. Reagan, Kennedy, Johnson, Truman, and Bush. I got them all.
You never met Eisenhower.
I never met Eisenhower. I never met Eisenhower, but I had a lovely ride along the highway in California, not too far behind him. Let me go on. I'll get back to the motorcade story, but let me go on with other heads of state.
Okay.
I spent 3 hours with NASA in his living room at the Army barracks in Cairo after he had become the head of state in Egypt. I met Diosdado Macapagal in the Philippines, in Manila, at a reception for the press, where I got to talk to him. I met Dubček, who was the one-time president of Czechoslovakia in the big revolt against the Soviets, the start of the end of Soviet rule in Russia began really in Czechoslovakia. And much later, when I was in Ankara, Turkey, doing the Fulbright professorship at the University of Ankara and also stringing for ABC, I was flying back from Istanbul to Ankara. And on the plane with me was Dubček, who had just been appointed the ambassador from Czechoslovakia to Turkey. And I had a camera and took pictures, and I tried to talk to him. He didn't want to talk to me. So I talked to him, and him saying, "I don't want to talk to you."
Do you want to talk about other famous people besides heads of state? Celebrities?
Celebrities. There were so many. The almost 10 years that I was doing monitor interviews, because as the West Coast representative for Monitor, I got to do the interviews with all fields. I was not only doing hard news inserts for news on the hour on Monitor, I was doing sports. I had all the sports interviews. I had all the celebrity interviews. I had the choice of a lot of talent. And the consequence of this was I was with one of the biggest contributors in the world to NBC's banner program, Monitor, from the Indian country, San Francisco.
Indian country.
Because I was in the position to control what stories were being done and who did them. I chose who to assign, and I assigned myself. In doing all of these interviews with celebrities, anyone who came into town of any national note was fair game. And the consequence was Yeah, I could reel off names. Fred Astaire.
So talk a little. I'll reel off names for you.
Ella Fitzgerald, Mel Torme.
But talk a little bit about what it was like when you interviewed Fred Astaire.
It was at the tail end of his career. They were doing Father of the Bride. I did Astaire, but that was just a routine interview, as was the interview I subsequently did with Robin Williams that I don't like to brag about. But the worst interview I ever did, from my standpoint, was with Marie Chevalier. It was done in Buenos Aires. He was appearing, doing a one-man show there, and he agreed to do a monitor interview with me. And he had one stipulation, that we didn't talk at all about the World War II years.
Oh, and there had been rumors that
There had been a lot of rumors and stories circulating that he had collaborated with the Nazis. And it was a distasteful period for France, for Chevalier, mm-hmm. for the world. And it was something that he just didn't want to talk about. He didn't want to deny it. He didn't want to accept it.
Just didn't want
he
to come out.
He didn't want to talk about it. And my assignment editor in New York said, the only thing we're interested in is the question you're going to ask about, was there any truth to him helping the Nazis? And so we did about 3 minutes of the interview about, you know, what he was doing in Buenos Aires and his long career. And I hit him with the question. Mm. And he blew up. That was the end of the interview. It was an interview that was never aired because it stopped at that point and threw me out.
Oh, really?
The only other time I've been thrown out of a story was with Jeremy Towers, the chef, Stars Restaurant. After I had left KRON, I worked for a short while for the Wall Street Journal. They wanted to do a thing on Stars Restaurant, which was having a phenomenal success in San Francisco, and Jeremy Towers was being touted as the new great wonder chef. And he agreed to the whole thing, and we went in with cameras and shot a lot of preliminary stuff. And then, I don't know what happened, but he got into an argument with the maitre d' about something and just was furious and turned on us and threw us out. We weren't even talking to him at the time. He said, get that television crew out of here. I mean, like, right now. Well, I had barely enough material to do a mishmash story that was used. But that was awful. But there were great interviews, too. And the two best ones that I think I enjoyed the most were with Alfred Hitchcock and with Yves Montand. The Alfred Hitchcock one was at the Fairmont Hotel in his suite. He was in the area when they were filming The Birds. An evening interview with Hitchcock was arranged for his hotel room, and I appeared on time at the door, knocked. He opened the door and said, Mr. Arnaud, what a pleasure to see you. I have been a longtime fan of you for many years. Well, as it turned out, he had a home in Santa Cruz, and when I was doing the Richfield Reporter, that was the newscast that he listened to late at night before going to bed. He knew me by voice, by reputation, and he made me feel as though he was being honored by sitting down with me and doing an interview for Monitor. The Yves Montan interview also was done at the Fairmont. Yves Montan was in San Francisco to do a one-man show. This was before he became known as much of an actor. He was a big time, the Sinatra of France.
He was a singer.
He was a singer. And his shows were singing French songs. Well, he was beginning to learn English. I had gone to the hotel to interview Simone Signoret, his wife, who spoke excellent English. And all the while I was doing this interview, she was draped out in a negligee on a sofa in the suite, and he was dressed because he was leaving for a rehearsal of the show he was doing in San Francisco. And he still had time, so I finished the interview with Simone Signoret, and I said, "How'd you like to try one, Eve?" He said, "I don't speak good enough." And I said, and Simone said, "You do. Why don't you try it? If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But try it." What followed was the first interview in English that Yves Montan ever did. It was wonderful. It was used. And he went on to learn to speak English a lot better afterward.
Yeah, he speaks beautifully. So I have a question. This is just a personal question. Because you've interviewed so many politicians and so many celebrities, what is the difference between interviewing those two types of people?
Not much. It's a story. It's a feature story with a celebrity, hoping to dredge out a piece of information that hasn't come out before, that isn't just the stock same answer. I can remember, along this line with Elsa Maxwell, who is the wife of Charles Laughton. I came out at her with a question right out of left field, like, "What's the most frightened you've ever been in your life?" Opened up just a floodgate. She escaped from a mugging on the street and went on to tell it with emotion. It was great. Okay, that's part of the story. You try to get something that, standard in interview, everybody tries to get something that hasn't been said before, something new. That's how that all comes about. With celebrities, it's feature material, it's inconsequential stuff. With politicians, it's deeper. With the scene of a disaster, you're looking for emotion. But it's all the same thing. It depends on the story.
Same with sports.
How you approach it.
Same with sports. I mean,
same with sports.
Because you covered Olympics, and were you?
I covered Olympics. Well, it still all goes back to Monitor, whereby I could do everything that Monitor needed from this area. And when it was a sports story that needed to be done, I did it. I did a lot of interviews with the Giants, with various members of other teams, with famous baseball players who came through town for whatever reason needed to be done.
The Olympics, you went to...
Olympics.
You went to Squaw Valley.
It all goes back to Monitor. My relationship with the entire Monitor crew, the upper echelon of Monitor in New York, was superb. We were all on a buddy-buddy basis. They liked my work. I liked the opportunity to be doing this stuff. It was money for me, too. But it was fame, too. I jumped into the big leagues with Monitor. And it just worked well. And when it came time for Olympics in 1960, CBS had the rights, both television and radio. But NBC had Monitor. And it was on weekends, so all we were concerned about was to get material to flood the weekends with Olympics. There were two things involved, not only my contacts with the guys in New York, but also the need to handle the prearranged. I was the NBC, the one network guy on scene in San Francisco. I had to arrange a lot of things for the Olympics at Squaw. And I found the home that the NBC crew, which consisted of about 10 people, some cameramen, recorders, shooting stuff that would be inserted into news broadcasts later, but they couldn't go live. CBS had the rights. And various technicians. I chose the house. I handled the negotiations for it. I hired the cook. I was given then the plum of being one of the two guys who would be doing the broadcasting. And that is how I ended up in Olympics. I studied a lot about games I never knew. I saw my first hockey game and did a broadcast on it. I went on from Squaw to Rome for the summer games, because everybody liked how well the winter games had gone.
Wow.
It was, again, being thrown into a whole new world of things that I knew little about. I did a story on the velodrome, which is the cyclists that go around, round and round. I didn't even know what a velodrome was before I did that broadcast, but I studied it and got all the information I could, and actually did a broadcast from the velodrome on the cyclist competition.
Wow.
In Rome, we were all over the lot. It was a great, great trip.
Was that the trip that you and Joanna took together?
Yes.
And left us at home?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Joanna and I flew from San Francisco to Rome. I was in first class. She was in coach.
How nice.
Well, NBC provided me with my ticket. I had to buy Joanna's. But there was no problem once we were in Rome, because I had a hotel room. And obviously, there was no expense to NBC for her to be there. I was doing everything in Rome. I learned to drive in Rome.
That sounds frightening.
I learned to drive, really. I've been driving for years, but never in the kind of helter-skelter traffic that Rome provides. NBC gave me a Fiat 600, which is smaller than a Volkswagen Bug, four-door. And I can't remember, maybe it was only a two-door. But part of my assignment, in addition to the broadcasting for Monitor, was I was the courier to get the film to the airport to be shipped to New York, where it would be processed and later broadcast. This is still film days.
Right.
And I had to drive that little Fiat all over the place, all the time, because of the runs to the airport. And I had the only NBC car, and you know how popular I was. I learned to drive nose driving. If you get your nose out in front of the other car, they can't hit you. They got to break it. And sure enough, it worked. I never had a scrape in Rome. I've had scrapes since, operating on that theory, but not in Rome.
Tell a story about the Eisenhower motorcade. Covering the Republican convention, or you were preparing to?
You're talking about taking Eisenhower in from the airport?
Yeah, there was a good story about what happened with that.
Since I was the local NBC radio man in San Francisco, they felt, this is 1956, when Eisenhower was up for his reincarnation, his second term. And since I was the man in San Francisco who knew the territory, my assignment was to bring Eisenhower in from the airport to San Francisco, and would take the net as needed when they wanted me to suddenly come back in. And I was to do the narration of the trip, Eisenhower's trip up from the airport to San Francisco, any crowds cheering and so forth. Just bring him in. Well, Don Hall, who was a crackerjack radio engineer at KNBC, and I had a car, and we tested it beforehand to know where the blind spots were, where we could broadcast from with the screwy transmission facilities at that time, and where we would go dead and where we'd come back again. So we had a map in advance, knowing when I could talk and when I couldn't. And the number of places I couldn't talk were not all that great. There was a period, I think, of about 5 miles that I was dead air. Eisenhower entourage from the airport included a lot of camera cars immediately behind, and Secret Service and police and highway patrol. I don't know how far behind Eisenhower we were, but we couldn't even see his car. But I had done a lot of preparation in advance of this. What could I be talking about? And I had a lot of notes about the terrain, the highway, the weather, the normal traffic on this road, just a lot of things to just jabber about that were meaningless, but there I was with Eisenhower, where I couldn't see him. And before we started the run-in from the airport in this entourage, I ran into Gabe Pressman, who was a friend of mine from childhood. He lived on the next street up from me on Sherman Avenue in the Bronx, and we both went to Morris High School. He was a class ahead of me in Morris. He's just slightly older. And Gabe went on to be the crackerjack ace correspondent for WNBC in New York.
Wow.
Gabe had quite a reputation and still does. He's, I forget the title he now has. He's still broadcasting. Something like chief correspondent or chief interpreter. Gabe was really big time.
Wow.
New York. And Gabe saw me. He says, "Hey, Ed, can I get a lift into the city?" I said, "Sure, I'm going to be doing broadcasts. I've got to track Eisenhower in." He said, "Oh, that's great. I'll just sit and listen to you. I took Stevenson in from the airport into Chicago for the Democratic convention." Well, it ended up that not only did Gabe and I ride in together, but we talked a lot about the differences between the Stevenson reception in Chicago and the Eisenhower reception in San Francisco. And I went through all my notes and talked, and Elmer Peterson was NBC's primo correspondent for television on the West Coast out of L.A. And Elmer was in the NBC camera car that was behind Eisenhower doing the narration for television. Well, NBC found that my narration was a lot more interesting than Elmer's. And at some point, I don't know where, They ran in my audio into the television. During this run also, a woman riding alongside of us on the freeway honked, waved at Don, who was driving, and said, pointing to her radio. And I thought, wow, she's listening to me right next in the next car. What a wonderful idea. I called on everyone in the country who is listening to this broadcast to honk their horn. And it went over wonderfully. It was that was one of my crowning achievements as an NBC narrator, correspondent, general BS artist on a program that lasted the run in from the airport was almost a half hour, maybe 20 minutes. I had 15 minutes with the dead air of a five. I had about 15 minutes all to myself to just talk.
But that story, it's almost like the movie Network, where you go to your windows, open the window, and yell, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
But if it hadn't been for that woman calling my attention to her listening to me, I never would have had the idea, but I thought it was a great idea. I can't remember anybody who ever pulled that.
That is a great idea.
That before or since.
This concludes Chapter 11.